I see many faces here tonight that are rather new to me. And I'm happy about this because I believe in turnover. I don't like the idea of a philosopher who has a kind of constant, cliquish following of disciples. Because I believe that the kind of philosophy I'm talking about is more like a medicine than a diet. And you don't want to get hooked on the medicine. It has a specific job to do, and then send you away. Of course, if you want to come back for kicks, it's a free country, and you always can. But basically, my idea in giving lectures and any kind of philosophical discourse is to set people free from me. It's like a good doctor. He's always trying to get rid of his patients because he knows that there are always an enormous, sort of indefinite supply of people who are going to be sick. And if he gets rid of patients, the patients he gets rid of will recommend those new ones to come, and he'll get rid of them too. And that's my attitude to all this. And that's why I'm giving a seminar this weekend on the worldly religions, which means being free from religion, so that your everyday life and your everyday profession and your everyday work becomes your religion, instead of being something that you feel bound to belong to and that you use as a crutch and as a support. Of course, I'm not against the idea of religious celebrations, of rituals, and so on, so long as you don't get hung up on them. As a matter of fact, if you do get hung up on a ritual, like many Catholics get hung up on the necessity of having to go to Mass every Sunday because it's their duty, they learn to hate it. And it comes out in their children because the parents hated going to Mass but felt they had to. The children hate it even more and don't do it. And thereby they deprive themselves of a celebration that would, under other circumstances, be a great delight. So we are going to move into an age now when our formal religious exercises, anything that can be branded as religion in quotes, will only survive if it's a great deal of fun. It will not survive if people do it as a solemn duty. On the other hand, the real religion is not so much in these symptomatic celebrations, and I'll call them symptomatic just in the same way as we'd say, if a person is blushing, it's symptomatic of a certain psychological state. So in the same way, if people are performing rituals in the right way, it's symptomatic of a certain interior joy and peace, which comes about because they don't need a religion anymore. They've been cured of religion by religion. Buddha gave the example of his doctrine, the Dharma or the method of Buddhism. He likened it to a raft for crossing a stream. Here's the raft. You get on it and you cross the stream. You get to the other side. Well, you certainly don't pick up the raft and carry it. But there are a lot of people who are kind of rafty. They love the raft. They stay on it. When they get to the other shore, they go back and pick up a new load and then bring it over again. And there you find all kinds of philosophers and clergy types and monks and people of that kind, who are, shall we say, addicted to religion. But I want to talk to you now about the non-addictive sort of thing, where the superior, the finest product of religion is something that doesn't look like religion at all, but is simply the practice of one's life. My old friend Frederick Spiegelberg of Stanford University called this the religion of no religion. You might say it's like when you get a great artist performing, it looks so easy. He doesn't seem to have any props. When a building is finished, the scaffolding disappears. And so in this way, there are certain people whose religion was like a vanished scaffolding, where they become or really in a certain way indistinguishable from ordinary people. And yet there's something about them that you can't quite put your finger on. You know there's a difference, but you can't say what it is. And so in Buddhist philosophy, the superbly enlightened person is likened to, let's say this verse from Chinese poetry. Entering the forest, he does not disturb a blade of grass. Entering the water, he does not make a ripple. In other words, his spiritual power, his religion, if you want, does not stand out like a sore thumb. There's a kind of anonymity to it. I remember once a great Japanese artist had done a piece of calligraphy for me. And it was amazing. He had just written on a hanging scroll, a kakemono, the numbers in Chinese characters, 1, 2, 3. But he'd done it very skillfully. And I was very pleased with it, and I hung it up in the my office, in the place where there was a kind of a tokonoma, or alcove. And just in the next few days, the great Zen scholar, Professor Suzuki, was going to pay a visit to us. And I said, well, I'm going to hang it up, and it's going to be there when Professor Suzuki comes. And the artist said, I hope he won't notice it. In other words, that it should be something so compatible and so congenial with the whole environment that it doesn't stand out like the sore thumb. So in that way, a person's religion can be something that becomes them, as distinct from something that they have a hang-up on. To be hung up on religion is just terrible. Because they're always talking about it, you're always trying to convert other people to your point of view, you're interminably discussing your opinions and saying, you know, it's just like you found a great doctor who has got the latest medicine for you to get hooked on. And you go around and you try and persuade all your friends to join up with you because that gives you a kind of feeling of confidence. The more people agree with you, the stronger you feel in your opinions. And all missionary work is based on this fallacy. So please understand from the start, when I'm talking to you, I am not trying to convert you. I'm not trying to do you any good. I'm just doing my own stuff. I talk this way like birds sing. It amuses me. I enjoy it because I'm interested. I'm full of wonder about this universe and full of all sorts of thoughts about it, and I like to share these with people. Not in order to interfere with your personal lives or make you dependent on me. Heaven forbid, if I had enough people dependent on me, I would have no sleep at nights at all. They'd be on the phone, they'd be hanging around, and said, go away. But simply that I think that with our exchange of ideas and rubbing ourselves against each other, we may find something of mutual interest. Now, let's not make any more ambitious claim for it than that. Because anything beyond that would be getting us into the world of power games, trying to influence people, trying to control people, and I'm not interested in that. So let me start by putting my cards on the table and saying more or less, as simply as I can, what my basic approach is to the whole question of religion, namely my feeling for, idea about, the nature of this thing we call life, the universe, and so on, is. It's very difficult to put it in the form of a belief or a set of propositions because what it begins from isn't ideas at all, but experience. I don't mean quite experience in the sense that a person says to an applicant for a job, how much experience do you have? I mean experience more in the sense of the word sensation. when you experience that water is cold by drinking it. You can't say, now I've experienced 22 times that water is cold and therefore I'm qualified about it. You see, you don't go about it that way. You just experience the actual sensation of drinking water. But what I call religion is based on that sort of state. It's based on a kind or modality of consciousness as to what all this is that's going on. Now, we are mostly brought up in all different kinds of cultures, not only Western, but African, Latin American, Eastern, and so on. The individual human being is by and large brought up to feel in some way that he's a puppet. There are various ways of describing man as a puppet. That he is, you see, it begins with childhood. When the child is made to feel a subordinate member of the family. Because when children come into the world, we play all kinds of funny tricks on them. We are not at all honest with them. The first thing you notice is that when people start talking baby language, that's not being fair with a child. You get these, I've been watching some educational television, and there are these sort of funny school teacher type girls who are very well-meaning, but they always roll their eyes and lift their eyebrows when they talk. And talk kind of simple, direct baby language of this kind. Dear children, we are all, what nice boy will do this, that, and the other, you know? Ugh. Because this isn't direct speaking at all. It's not as the way you'd speak to each other. It's creating children as a separate class. And a child, if you don't treat a child in the same way as you would treat any other person, the child is instantly bewildered. Why do you come on to me in a different way you come on to somebody else? Because when we don't welcome children frankly into this world, saying, how do you do? You're another one of us. And we're going to explain to you what's going on. We're playing the following games, and these are the rules of the games. And if you will please understand these rules, you will later on maybe be able to think up better ones. But what we do is we mystify children. And we put them all through all kinds of complicated grades of initiation. And most of us, therefore, grow up as still children. We grow up always thinking that there is a parent above us. And if our parents are long ago dead, and now I am a grandfather, I have five grandchildren. See? And therefore I am able to, I suppose, assume in their eyes as much authority and as much dignity as my own grandfather did. But I know I'm just as stupid as he was. So, because you see, in our most impressionable years, we get the idea constantly, there is someone up there and behind who knows the answers. And to a certain extent they do, because they're more experienced, they've practiced skills, they're more developed in certain ways. But we never are really able to get people to grow up, to come into the state of adulthood, without still taking the infantile attitude. There is something and someone who knows the answers better than we do. And therefore, we always have, through this kind of childhood indoctrination, an attitude towards the universe and towards the ultimate reality behind it of as if we were on probation, as if somehow we were interceding. We were saying constantly to the Lord God, please forgive me for having the disgusting effrontery to exist. And that goes back, you see, to archaic notions of the world. as if it were a political state modeled after the political states of the ancient Near East, where great tyrant kings were the fathers and rulers of the people. I'm constantly puzzled as to how the citizens of a republic, such as the United States, who are supposed to believe that a republic is the best form of government, can believe that the universe is a monarchy. It is a completely inconsistent idea. If the universe is a monarchy, then the monarchy is the best form of government, and you ought to have one here. No, I rather feel, if I can put this into words at all, this sort of experience, that we are not strangers in this universe. Although we've all been somehow, slightly with our own connivance, been hoodwinked into thinking that we are. And we say, I came into this world. I feel myself put upon by fate, by chance, by my environment or whatever. And we take the attitude that we are in some way or other victims of the scheme of things. And therefore most of what we experienced is defined as what happens to us. And only a very small part of what we experience is defined as that which we ourselves do and wish and decide upon. So we feel experience as a conflict on the one hand between our efforts and willing and wishing, and on the other hand, what simply happens. And therefore we feel sort of tossed about like ships on an enormous swell in relation to the rest of the world. But when you really consider your own existence, you can't account for it as something introduced into this world from outside. What you are as a total being, that is not only what you think and are aware of, but also all that you don't think about and aren't aware of, the whole structure of your organism. That you are this is a symptom, an expression of the whole thing that's going on. In a certain sense, you are just as much a part of an essential expression of the universe as the sun is, or a galaxy is. Only, we tend to think of ourselves as discontinuous with the whole thing. In this way, when you look, let's say, at a photograph in a newspaper, you look at it with a magnifying glass, the picture disappears, and you see only an area of dots. But when you stand away from it and drop the magnifying glass, the dots merge into a face. So when you look at anything close up, you don't see its relatedness to everything else. Look at the dots under the magnifying glass, and you don't see their connection with the face. So, our view of our own personal lives, our own work, and our own personal circumstances is a very close-up view. And we don't see how it fits in with some larger design. We're too close to it. And we can argue it doesn't fit in. We feel we really are separate. We're not connected with this whole thing. Our life, my life as an individual, is just a flash between two darknesses. Well, there are all sorts of other flashes going on before we were born and after we die. Flash, 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 flash. But between all these different flashes, which are like the dots in the newspaper photograph, there are, for those who want to see, connections. After all, you think of your body as a connected, unified reality. But if you look at your body from a certain point of view, you are composed of molecules that are vastly separate in space. But because those molecules are so tiny, and the separations between them so tiny as to escape your notice, you don't see that you're nothing as you stretch out your apparently solid arm. This is just all the way down. See? Is that some bird?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. So, it's all right. Don't interrupt him, because he's going to make a very amusing comments at certain points. But you see this, that when you take the small in view, you don't see the connectedness. And therefore, you would say now, is this the solidity, the continuity of this arm, is that real? And a person who always thinks in terms of the microscopic would say, no, it's not real, it's only an illusion. The reality is all those separate molecules. Then the physicist comes along to him and says, that's a lot of nonsense. Those molecules aren't there at all. They're only minute electrons and other subnuclear particles. But actually, you see, every party's point of view is correct. It is correct that there are these widely separated little particles. But it is also correct that there is a unity through the whole thing. So in just the same way, we looking myopically at our own lives and seeing ourselves all as separate bodies and feeling that each one of us has a separate time beginning with birth and ending with death, we are blind to the way in which each one of us is really absolutely integrated with everything else that's going on. But so long, you see, as we are all brought up to feel that we are here on sufferance, then we are to that extent emotionally prejudiced against seeing that each one of us is really a particular way of looking at all that there is, and a particular way of being responsible for all that there is. You, in other words, yes, you did it, and are to be praised or blamed, or neither, for everything that's happening. When we say, well, that wasn't my fault, it was those scapegoats, whether they be Jews, communists, Turks, infidels, heretics, Chinese, Vietnamese, Africans, any Catholics, Birchers, New Leftists, anybody you can think of you don't like, you can always say, well, they started it. They're the cause of the trouble. But the real secret is that you're responsible for everything that's going on. And there is in you everything that is angelic about human beings and everything that's diabolic. And the question is, how do you play those two together? So putting it in this way, then, I would say simply that life is the play, and I underline the word play, of a single energy. And you are that energy. That energy, like all energy, is a pulsation. And therefore we have the appearance and disappearance of its pulses. You could say, I, defined as a certain human body called Alan Watts, am a pulse of this energy. And therefore, I have my presence is inseparable from my absence, as is the case with all waves and pulses. A wave must have an upside and a downside, or shall we say a crest and a trough, where it is and where it isn't. And so every pulse of the universal energy has an on and an off. We call that life and death. Or it may be waking and sleeping, or now you see it, now you don't. And this thing is just what we all are. From the highest point of view, it never makes mistakes. When you watch the clouds, did you ever accuse a cloud of being aesthetically malformed? Did you ever think that mountains were to be criticized for their outline? Did you ever think that the stars were badly arranged, or that the patterns in foam had something to be desired? No. But of course we feel that about ourselves just because of our close point of view to ourselves. If we looked at ourselves sub specie eternitatis, from the standpoint of eternity, we should see that our lives, in every detail and in every respect, were as harmonious and exquisite as the patterns on seashells. And we should find that everything that was a mistake, that was done wrong, was actually an integral part of a harmonious relationship. Only we couldn't see it that way from our limited point of view. So one could say that at the highest level, this universe is an incomparable jewel of harmonious, dancing, patterning energy. Very intelligent. In the sense of, what do we mean by intelligence? A complex, harmonious design. Included in this harmonious design is, of course, the fact that we feel it not to be so. Our objections to what we wrongly think of as the disharmony of the universe, the very fact that those objections occur, are an integral part of the harmony. So that if I feel furious with somebody like Hitler because he kills ever so many people, like the massacre of the Jews, I would not say that it was wrong for me to feel furious, but simply that too, If his slaying of the Jews is, after all, part of this harmonious thing, so is my fury about it. From the highest point of view, the most inclusive point of view, it all goes together. And if you understand that, if you actually feel in your bones, if you sense that as a vivid sensation, a very curious thing happens to you. You are able to function in your everyday life without hang-ups. It's like this. Everybody is really using an enormous amount of energy protecting themselves. And a lot of the energy we're using is only thinking about how we would protect ourselves if we were challenged to do so. We waste an incredible amount of psychic energy in the state of inner cramp, tension, of anxiety about what will happen if, supposing. Now, put yourselves in the position of realizing that you are walking and dancing around in a space like a trapeze artist. But there's no concrete below you to fall onto. You can do anything you want, any crazy act, flip any way you wish, and although you may go through the illusion of a crash, there is never a real crash. You've nothing to lose, because you are, in fact, the whole works. Only, the whole works has a most interesting device in it, which is pretending that it's in danger, that it could come to a final end. This is the familiar phenomenon of goosing yourself, of giving yourself a scare, as if the universe were a system that crept up behind itself and said, boo! So it jumps, see? And each jump is like the new spring of the grasshopper going along. Every time it gets to itself, boo, and it jumps, you see? Boo, jumps, like this. Because you have to understand this. This is terribly important. A lot of people think, you see, that the goal of life, the thing that you really should get hold of is power, to be in control. And you can take all kinds of lessons on master your life, be in control of this, be in control of that. Now let me let you into a secret. What the real meaning of all these things is, that when you study the whole philosophy and psychology of power, and you really go to the end of it, you'll find that that's not what you want. Imagine, let your fantasy go, make yourself the master magician. You can read everybody's mind. You know the future completely and clearly. You need not be subject to the ordinary conditions of nature. Supposing, for example, you could renew your body all the time and never need to die. Supposing you could be anywhere you wanted to be in the universe at the slight quiver of a whim. Go through this. Think this through. Everybody thinks they want power. But if you really think through what situation you would be in if you had absolute power, you would say, man, who needs it? You wouldn't want it, because you would be completely bored. So power is not the thing we really want. There is nothing more instructive in the world than to think out systematically and thoroughly what it is that you do want. And curiously enough, the best you will come to is that you don't know. Because you want a surprise. Now, you can't surprise yourself. You see? If you're in control and you plan a surprise, it's obviously not a surprise. But you see, once you could imagine God, who came to the conclusion in eternity that he knew it all, he had to create something and said to it, surprise me. And that was man. Of course it was God, because God had a system in himself whereby he could let his left hand not know what his right hand was doing. It's like when you play chess with yourself. And you take each side in the game, quite honestly, and try to make it win. Well, one of the most interesting exercises, take a couple of knitting needles, or those cocktail picks that look like swords, and have a fencing match between your left hand and your right hand. And really try to get digs in, but let the other hand be equally defensive against the digs. It's very interesting. That's a good exercise in yoga, to do that. Find out a lot about yourself that way. Let not your left hand know what your right hand doeth. But that's the sort of system we're in, you see. That's like this universe. Because if you understand that you don't want power, not really, you always want to be getting a little more power, but you don't want final power. Because then nothing would happen. It's just like when you're playing a game, maybe bridge, maybe chess, or whatever it is. And at the moment that the outcome of the game becomes certain, you cancel the game and begin again. Because there's no fun in a game with a certain outcome. Might just as well not play it. Because any future that is certain is already past in the sense that you've had it. So, I look then upon what we're doing in this world, that every one of us is a particular expression at a particular time and a particular place of the whole thing. Basically, you are the witch than which there is no witcher. You are the Godhead. And you don't have to think of that in terms of an old gentleman with a beard. You are basically the Godhead. But this energy, intelligent energy, is capable of expressing itself in myriads of forms, each one with a different point of view. Like your eyes look out of your head, each one with a different point of view. All your nerve ends are there in your skin, almost like the horns on a little snail, all feeling around. Everyone is you looking from a different point of view towards the world. So, in turn, I can see all human beings' eyes as many, many horns on a cosmic snail, all looking out from a single center. All of us, appearing and disappearing, coming and going. We pop out and we pop in. We are born and we die. We are thrown out and withdrawn. And as you watch this, you see, from a larger point of view, you see a throbbing rhythm, each time coming out with a different variation. One day we could call it John Doe, the next time it's Jimmy Smith, the next time it's, you know, it throbs. It has little subtle variations in it each time, each one worthy of being given a different name. But it's all the same energy doing this. Now, obviously, if you aren't aware of that, and you think seriously that you're just poor little me, who got thrown into this world by some irresponsible parents, and the saddle suddenly with all these problems, and that all it's going to be is that you've got to struggle along as long as you can, and maybe raise some children to struggle along in the same idiotic way you do, and then give up. And you generally feel frustrated and cheated by the whole scheme of things, because you do not acknowledge that you are responsible for it. That you got yourself into this situation. That you were the evil gleam in your father's eye when he pursued your mother. You were your father. Because he feels in just the same situation you did. He feels he's an eye, too, cast into this world. And he may have been brought up, just like you, to feel that he had nothing to do with anything else, that he was somehow disconnected from the whole scheme of things, and merely experiencing it passively as something that happens to you, that is thrown upon you. So long as you choose to feel about things in that way, you complain and you are frustrated and you're fighting and bitching about the whole thing. Which is, of course, all right, because that's what you want to do. Only that you could see there's a certain joke in that. Indicates that it could be different. That you don't need to be in that state of mind in regard to it. That you could wake up from this illusion of separateness and understand that you aren't just a little animalcule crawling around on the surface of a globular rock that revolves around an insignificant star on the outer edge of one of the minor galaxies. But that you are a special case of the center, what there is and of all that there is. You know, it's interesting that in a view of the universe which sees space as curved, imagine for a moment this is not quite correct, but that all objects in space are on the surface of a sphere, then you will see at once that every point on the surface of a sphere can be regarded as the center of the surface. Where is the central point of the surface of the sphere? Anywhere. So in this way, we can legitimately regard every point in this universe as being the center of the whole thing. And it's in this multi-centered sense that every eye which looks around and sees the world as something that spins around you and you're the axis, you're quite correct. It does. But you know how it is when you hold in your hand a gyroscope. Yes, isn't it? It always feels alive, doesn't it? Because it surprises you. It wants to move in a direction which you didn't predict. And that movement of the gyroscope that you hold, that seems to be against you, is the movement in life we call other, or what happens to us. When we feel, on the other hand, that I am moving the gyroscope in the direction I want it to go, that's what we call self, that's what we call voluntary. And you can't possibly know the one without the other. You don't know what you mean by self unless you know what you mean by other. And you don't know what you mean by the voluntary, what I want to happen, except in contrast and play against the involuntary, what happens to me. But just as in the gyroscope, the voluntary and the involuntary, the self and the other, are two poles of the same experience. So, when you understand this, it is as if you had become one with, or had a firm grasp of, the axis of the gyroscope. And you know that when the north side is going the way I want it, the south side is going in the opposite way. And it's really all one. Only it has to polarize itself in this way so that there shall be something happening. That's the condition of the game. So then, we can say then there are two poles in another way. We'll call one pole involution and the other pole evolution. Involution is all that aspect of life in which we get involved in the schemes, in the games, in the conflicts, in the quarrels. So involved that we lose sight of the forest for the trees. And there comes a point, as in every movement, where that is so extreme that it has to swing up again in another direction, where we see the forest over and above the trees. And that is evolution. Where we, for example, in our present-day culture, have gone through a historical sort of psychological historical development which has emphasized our consciousness of ourselves as individuals to an extraordinary degree. Never before in the history of man have people concerned themselves so much with the plight of the individual. Never before have there been such social services that would take every person into consideration, or at least go through the motions of doing so. Never before was it thought important that every individual should have the chance, say, of being given hospital treatment in sickness, all these sort of things, see? But in doing this, we've raised a new kind of problem. The individual, having been brought to so great a realization of his individuality because of the importance which society places upon him, isn't quite sure that that's where he wanted to be. Be careful of what you desire, you may get it. The individual, so critically emphasized, therefore turns towards going beyond individuality. Now, he can do that in two ways. He can go beyond individuality by submerging himself. That is to say, by mindless and thoughtless adoption of a fanaticism. By joining some mass movement, some fanatical religion, some form of screwy politics, and by working for this cause, be equally delivered from individuality as if he became stoned drunk. It's the same thing. There's nothing much to choose between the two. Or, by going right to the extreme of individuality, instead of trying to forget one's lonely self-ego feeling, go right into it. And through becoming an individual as intensely as you can become one, by becoming as separate as you can get, you will discover in a very natural way that you are the eternal self behind the whole thing. There's that wonderful passage that is quoted in Memoirs of the Poet Tennyson, where he describes the way in which as a young boy he often used to be alone and used to repeat his own name to himself, saying, "Alfred, Alfred." And you know, he got feeling that this thing called Alfred, this particular I, is kind of spooky. You, look at yourself in the mirror. Don't look away, you know. A lot of people feel awkward when they look at themselves in the mirror. They don't quite want to look at themselves. Sometimes if you feel your own pulse, you feel that thing going throb, throb inside you, your finger starts to itch and you want to rub it off like that, you see. Your own inner processes, your own gut, is something queer. But if you don't turn away from that, and you keep looking right into your own eyes in the mirror, at first you say, "You rascal, you fraud, you devil." You go on looking, and you go deeper and deeper and deeper looking into your own eyes. And then Tennyson goes on to say, after he had said this name, Alfred, to himself several times, got this extraordinary feeling coming over him, in which he knew with total certainty that beyond this little thing called Alfred, there was this absolutely eternal life that was forever and ever was the root and ground of everything. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of going back in your mind to childhood and feeling that there's an immeasurably ancient you behind your childhood. A very knowing, ancient of days. But that's what happens, you see, when you go through the experience of individuality to an extreme point. It very naturally explodes into the universal. Whereas if you withdraw from individuality, you are liable never to come across that. You just get caught up in the fashions and fads and customary escapes, which are the solace of most people. That's, you see, the reason for being a hermit. Hermits are people who pursue individuality to an extreme. They go off into complete solitude. And the most interesting thing you will find in the state of complete solitude, when you get really alone, you find that you are connected with everything. Because what happens in complete solitude is that your ears become sensitized. And you hear all the sounds you weren't accustomed to hearing. You hear your own heartbeat. You hear the singing in your own ears. You hear the buzz of innumerable tiny insects you never paid attention to before. You hear the sound of the wind and every leaf responding to it. And you suddenly realize that the leaves rippling to the wind and your eardrums rippling to it are all one process. That you, indeed, are like a whirlpool in a stream. The pattern is constant, but the water is always changing. You are a shimmering manifestation like the flame of a candle, which is really a stream of gas, but never for 2 minutes the same. You are a dancing vibration, and on either end of you is the whole energy of the universe flowing through what is called you and wiggling in the recognizable form and then going on, you see? You are a wave waving of this energy. And we're all that, you see? It's doing that. The hermit finds this out. Because by going into complete isolation, he discovers there is no isolation. He becomes so sensitive to every tiniest vibration. And when he discovers that, then the good hermit comes back into the world. And even though he's involved in the busyness and turmoil of everyday life, he still sees this. So what is important for us to learn? We're all, most of us, involved in some kind of frantic business. And what I want to suggest to you is that this frantic business can be your yoga, your way of liberation. But you don't have to get out of it. You don't necessarily have to drop out, although that's important for some people. Depends whether you have the vocation to drop out or whether you have the vocation to stay in. But you, I would not only say it is, would help to make your everyday life into a yoga, but that you won't really be able to stand it if you don't. It's not, as some people say, can we Westerners practice Oriental disciplines? The question is, if you can't, you're not going to survive. You won't be able to take it. So let's get to the point of view where we can see certain types of activity which are normally associated with extreme anxiety, such as various forms of business where we always worry whether we're going to make the payments, whether we're going to make the profit, whether we're going to do this, that, and the other. And day to day, there's this constant anxiety going on. Now, there is a point of view from which those activities can be conducted as complete play and dancing. When you realize that you don't give a damn how it comes out. And it's only when you get to the point that you don't give a damn that you can afford to do these sort of things at all. If you do give a damn, you can't afford to get involved in that kind of business. It'll just wreck your nerves and gives you ulcers. So it's terribly important not to give a damn. We ordinarily think that people who don't give a damn will collapse on the job, will have no motivation. That's because they're not striving for power anymore. They realize that the striving for power is futile. So if you realize that striving for power is futile, what else will you do? What other zest will there be? A lot of people think that if you deprive people of the urge for power, they will have no motivation to do anything. What would be the motivation, shall we call it, if you're not interested in power? Why would you do anything? Why would you make any effort if it isn't that you want to control things? What do you put in the place of the striving for power?
Fun.
Yeah? Or to be surprised.
I think you said it when we were describing why you're here.
Yeah.
You were saying, I say these things because for the same reasons as the birds say.
Yeah, right, right.
For you, that's your substitute for describing the power.
Right.
For me, it might be somewhat different, but I would do what I do.
Yes, but you will realize now at once that there are several alternatives. There isn't only the fun, which is one of them, but say, there is also compassion. Where you see a lot of human beings are really suffering, and you can feel out. Now, goodness, that's not necessary. You don't have to do it that way. And this may supply a great deal of energy, you see. But the moment your energy is released from the power game and from the self-protection game, it's free to do all kinds of other things. You get a tremendous access. Now, wait a minute. Let's have an intermission now, and then we can bring up questions after about 5 minutes intermission. Okay?